So in this section, we're going to be talking medical factors. Obviously, you probably know a lot of this stuff already from getting your private pilot certificate. You know that how long your third class medical certificate is valid for. You also know that just because you have a third class medical certificate doesn't mean that you're just good to go fly anytime. If something changes with your health or perhaps you start taking medication that's not FAA approved, then you may have to go ahead and call up the AME, get their opinion, and see if you can continue flying or if you have to sideline yourself for a little bit. Anytime you're taking an over-the-counter medication or medication that's not explicitly approved by the FAA, good idea to call the AME and make sure that it is going to be okay for you to take those meds. And if not, maybe they could recommend something that would be FAA approved, get you switched over to some different medication so that you can continue your flight training and can continue flying and exercising those third-class medical privileges. Now, being that people are just people, right? We're all susceptible to a number of physical issues when we expose our bodies to flying, high altitude, all that sort of stuff. And that's what we're going to start talking about here in this topic. So first one up is hypoxia. Yeah, a lot of this stuff you probably know from your prior pilot, but it's good to review it, and it's still going to be on your instrument written exam, still possibly going to be on that instrument oral exam during your check ride. So four different types of hypoxia. What are the four different types? Hypoxic, hypemic, stagnant, and histotoxic. So those are our four types. And you're like, oh, I thought there's just one. Hypoxia, typically you think, hey, if you're hypoxic, you're probably flying too high, you don't have enough oxygen, you need to descend or use some supplemental oxygen or both. Well, that is the hypoxic hypoxia. So basically it's a lack of oxygen available to the lungs, and the remedy is descend or use supplemental oxygen or both. For hypemic hypoxia, that means that blood's not able to bind to and transport oxygen from the lungs to the rest of your body. This is most commonly caused by CO poisoning. So this would be carbon monoxide poisoning, would cause hypemic hypoxia. And the remedy that we have for this is, as you probably know, turn off the heaters, open the air vents, descend, and use supplemental oxygen. Most importantly there, turn off the heaters, trying to kill the source of CO, and open up the air vents, get fresh air in that cockpit. Next, we have stagnant hypoxia. Stagnant hypoxia means that the blood is not flowing and transporting oxygen. An example of this could be high G-forces. So if you're in a steep spiral because you got disoriented, you're pulling back on the yoke or stick really hard, pulling some G-forces, well, that could pull blood away from your brain or kind of stop the flow of blood, and that would not allow blood to transport oxygen. So the remedy to this one is don't do aerobatics without lots of proper training and proper equipment. Pretty simple there. Next, we have histotoxic hypoxia. That's our fourth type. Histotoxic hypoxia, keyword toxic there, right? So this will help you remember what it is. The inability of the tissue to use the oxygen in the blood due to drugs or alcohol. Drugs and alcohol are toxic, right? So histotoxic hypoxia would be the inability of the tissue to use the oxygen in the blood because of a certain medication you're on, because you're super drunk, any of those number of reasons that would be causing histotoxic hypoxia. The remedy here is only use approved drugs and do not fly with any alcohol in your system. Do not allow passengers on board your aircraft who are impaired by any alcohol or drugs. So if they're at all impaired, do not allow them to get on board your aircraft. Those effects of drugs and alcohol only get worse as altitude increases. Now, some of the other signs of hypoxia are going to be euphoric feeling, blue fingertips and lips, slurring of speech, headache, slowed response time, lightheaded or dizzy sensation, and tingling in the fingers and toes. Now, hypoxia obviously is different than hyperventilation. Hyperventilation, this is when you have too little carbon dioxide in your blood. So this could be due to breathing rapidly in a panic, hyperventilating. And the remedy here is to slow your breathing and, if possible, breathe into a paper bag to restore the proper balance of oxygen and CO2 in your system. The signs of hyperventilation, aside from a noticeably high breathing rate, are visual impairment, unconsciousness, that's bad, lightheaded or dizzy sensation, tingling sensations, hot and cold sensations, and muscle spasms. So, what you can do, besides just forcing yourself to breathe slower, is talk. If you're talking, it's really hard to hyperventilate and speak. You kind of have to stop hyperventilating to speak into the microphone or speak to your passenger. So that can really help you slow your breathing rate. If you feel like you're a little anxious there and you feel like you might be hyperventilating a bit and you're getting any of those signs, visual impairment, unconsciousness, lightheaded or dizzy sensation, tingling sensations, hot and cold sensations, or muscle spasms, well, maybe you should just start speaking more, and that will help you slow that breathing rate. Remember, paper bag, not plastic bag. Big difference there. As you can see, the signs are similar to hypoxia between hyperventilation and just regular old hypoxia. So it's really important for you as a pilot to correctly diagnose what you're experiencing so you can act accordingly. If this is left unchecked, hyperventilation can lead to unconsciousness as the body's natural defense mechanism to restore the proper balance of CO2 and oxygen in the blood is basically just to shut down and put you to sleep. That's really bad if you're trying to fly an airplane, especially if you're on an instrument approach or something like that, or really any time. So think about the differences there between hyperventilation and hypoxia, and note the different types of hypoxia, those four different types, how CO poisoning is one type, how flying too high is another. Another type could just be due to G-forces, and the last type is due to drugs or alcohol typically. Moving on here, we're going to talk about the middle ear and some sinus problems. So just due to the design of your ear, as it's pictured here on the left, if you're listening to this audio file while you're in the gym running or driving, you may not be able to actually see below here in the lesson. But due to the design of your ear, we have a little diagram down there to help you out. It's easier for the air to escape than it is for air to re-enter. So that's the estuation tube, which I most likely am mispronouncing, and I have ever since I became a pilot. But the estuation tube, or estation tube, I believe is the more proper term there. That is what is causing your ear to pop as you go up and down. Now, this is the same for private pilots as it is for instrument pilots, whether it's happening to you or your passenger. Any sort of fluid or congestion can really aggravate this. And if you have somebody with severe ear pain, or you experience severe ear pain while you're descending, it's best to go back to your initial altitude, climb back up, and then try to clear your ears more often by swallowing or chewing gum or yawning, and descend more slowly to try to equalize that differential pressure on your eardrum. Bottom line is, at the end of the day, you have a limited number of gallons of gas on your airplane, a limited amount of fuel, so limited number of minutes you can stay in the air. You can't stay up there forever just because your ears hurt. Eventually, you're going to have to come down, deal with the pain, and if your eardrum does burst, well, generally, it will repair itself. It will heal over a matter of weeks or potentially months, but you can lose hearing. So don't go flying, and don't allow other people to fly on board your aircraft if they're congested at all, and try to avoid going to super high altitudes if you ever suspect somebody having any sort of ear issues or sinus issues. Moving on here to motion sickness and air sickness. Well, it's caused by the brain receiving conflicting messages about the state of the body. So a pilot may experience motion sickness during initial flights, but it generally goes away within the first few lessons because you can see outside and your body kind of gets used to that. Obviously, anxiety and stress don't help this any. But now that you're getting back in the clouds and you can't see outside, but you're still experiencing the sensation of turning and climbing and descending, that can kind of make you a little nauseous again for those first couple flights under the foggles. It may take some time to get over this, and you will have to talk to your CFI and your doctor about approved ways if you need to take any sort of medication. Like ginger gum is approved from the FAA, but obviously Dramamine is not. So you need to talk with them about any sort of extra things you might need help with to overcome some of that motion sickness if it's a factor for you. Some of the things that'll help is keep some fresh air flowing in the cockpit. Make sure you're focusing on objects outside. If you are in VFR conditions and you can remove foggles and just take a few minutes, focus on something far off in the distance. Avoid unnecessary head movements. Try not to close your eyes and look down. That typically does not help at all. And just keep in mind, Dramamine is great for passengers to prevent air sickness, but it is really not recommended for you as a pilot. And in fact, it's actually a prohibited medication from the FAA. Now, carbon monoxide poisoning, I know we talked about this a little bit before, but this is our next section we want to cover here. So carbon monoxide, just to refresh, it's colorless, it's odorless, and it's produced by all internal combustion engines as a result of burning fuel. It attaches itself to the hemoglobin in the blood about 200 times more easily than oxygen. So CO ultimately prevents the hemoglobin from carrying actual oxygen to the cells. Instead it carries CO there. Your body can't use CO. It needs actual O2 to be able to use that, and you start kind of shutting down, getting a headache, all of that. A big sign is the smell of exhaust. Although CO is colorless and odorless, it's typically combined in with exhaust fumes. So if you smell exhaust in the cockpit, you should really pay close attention and make sure that you're not getting any sort of CO poisoning. Perhaps open up some air vents, check and see if you have the heater on. Perhaps you have to turn the heat off. The most common way you're going to get CO poisoning in the cockpit, aside from just cracked exhaust and bad airflow and stuff like that, is going to be turning on the cabin heat with a malfunctioning heat exchanger on your exhaust. So if you have a crack on the exhaust pipe or something, or in that heat exchanger, and you're leaking exhaust fumes directly into your heat, that would not be good. Next up, we have stress and fatigue. This affects all pilots, all passengers, but stress is the body's response to physical and physiological demands that are placed upon it. So a little bit of stress is a good thing. It helps you kind of stay alert and perform well. A little bit of stress. A lot of stress, like flying single pilot in IFR conditions, well, that can be really stressful and perhaps a little bit too much, especially when you're a newly instrument-rated pilot. The body's reaction to stress includes releasing chemical hormones, such as adrenaline, into the blood and increasing metabolism to provide more energy to the muscles. Sounds like a great way to lose weight, right? Just get super stressed and you'll lose weight, although it actually doesn't work that way. Blood sugar, heart rate, respiration, blood pressure, and precipitation all increase when you're stressed. The term stressor is used to describe an element that causes an individual to experience stress. Examples of stressors include physical stress, noise or vibration, physiological stress, fatigue, and psychological stress, something difficult at work or personal situations, difficult at home, you know, any sort of relationship issues, that can all cause psychological stress. Stress falls into two broad categories, though: acute, short-term, and chronic stress, long-term. Acute stress involves an immediate threat that is perceived as danger, like, whoop, whoop, pull up. That's an immediate threat, and that's very acute. Now, this type of stress that triggers it's the type of stress that triggers a fight or flight response in the individual. So whether their threat is real or imagined, imagine back to when you were doing stalls as a student, if you're nervous about it, it could trigger a fight or flight mechanism in you when you're freaked out about the airplane stalling. And the problem with that is whether the threat is real or imagined, right? There's actually no real threat to doing stalls at a safe altitude with your CFI on board showing you how it's done, but you could imagine that there is one. So fully understanding what you're getting yourself into and understanding what kind of flight you're getting yourself into, understanding how your airplane works, all that can eliminate at least all those imagined stressors and really serve to reduce stress as a whole, because now you're just stressed about the things that really matter, not the things that could potentially matter. You're worried about mattering, but they really actually don't. Now, chronic stress can be defined as a level of stress that persists and presents an intolerable burden. So it exceeds the ability of an individual to cope, and it causes individual performance to fall sharply. So unrelenting physiological pressures such as loneliness or financial worries and relationship or work problems can produce a cumulative level of stress that exceeds a person's ability to cope with the situation. When stress reaches these levels, performance falls off rapidly. Even though you might remove yourself from the stressful work situation and go to a flight lesson afterwards, go for a flight somewhere, you're probably not going to have your best performance. Pilots experiencing from this level of stress are not safe and should not exercise their airman privileges. Pilots who suspect they are suffering from chronic stress should consult a physician, and it's a good thing to talk about with your CFI and other people who are close to you as well. If you have real problems at work or in relationships, that's going to affect you. Even though you feel 100%, it's going to really affect your ability to fly the airplane. Now, as we jump into fatigue, so that was all stress-related, let's talk about fatigue. Fatigue is frequently associated with pilot error, right? That's why the airlines have all those rules about, hey, you can only fly for so many hours at a time to try to make sure the pilots aren't too tired. Some of the effects of fatigue include degradation of attention and concentration, impaired coordination, and decreased ability to communicate. These factors seriously influence the ability to make effective decisions. Physical fatigue results from sleep loss, exercise, or physical work. Factors such as stress and prolonged performance of cognitive work result in mental fatigue. Like stress, fatigue falls into two broad categories, acute and chronic. Acute fatigue is short-term and is a normal occurrence in everyday living. It's a kind of tiredness people feel after a period of strenuous effort, you know, going to the gym and working out, or you know, maybe just one poor night's sleep. Rest after exertion and 8 hours of sleep ordinarily cures this acute fatigue condition. Now, chronic fatigue is different. Chronic fatigue is when you have several bad nights sleep in a row, and then that kind of builds up into just this ongoing thing that's really hard to overcome, and it takes a long time for that to go away. It takes multiple days or weeks to recover from that. You can't just recover from one good night's sleep, and chronic fatigue needs to be recognized because it takes so long to recover from it, and you'll typically make overly optimistic decisions when you're chronically fatigued, and those overly optimistic decisions are usually bad decisions. The rest of the section on aeromedical factors is a big recap from Private Pilot. We'll run through it real quickly here for you. Feel free to read the text below if you want a more in-depth dive. Dehydration and nutrition, obviously, don't be dehydrated. Carry bottles of water on board the aircraft so that you can keep yourself hydrated. Common signs of dehydration are headache, fatigue, cramps, sleepiness, or dizziness. Now, with nutrition, if you get a little jittery, a little shaky, if you get any of those other signs, could be that you just haven't eaten anything in a really long time. Make sure you keep some snack bars around so you can just get some calories, some sort of sugar in you to keep your body functioning properly until you can get through the flight. Or better yet, if you suspect that you're really hungry or you haven't eaten properly throughout the day, don't go flying in the first place. Next up, hypothermia. Wintertime flying can be really beautiful, but there are certain things you really need to consider. You can get really cold when you're flying in the airplane, especially if you can't use the heater because you suspect any sort of carbon monoxide poisoning or any sort of leaks there. So if you don't have a good heater or you can't use it, then hypothermia becomes a real thing. You might be warm getting in the airplane, but after hours of sitting there or after a prolonged time sitting, not moving, your body's not making much heat, and you can get very cold to the point where it's hard to fly the airplane. Also keep in mind that just because the heater is working and you're nice and toasty warm in the airplane, if you don't get to a nice comfy airport, well, you might want to consider that in how you dress. You should dress as if you're going to have to spend a long time outside, because if you do have any sort of off-airport excursions there where you can't make it back to an airport and you do land in a field somewhere or something like that or on a road, you're going to want to be dressed for it in the wintertime. Hypothermia is a real thing that can kill you or really make it difficult to fly, potentially kill you when you're flying, and certainly kill you once you end up somewhere that you don't have any appropriate shelter. Lastly here, we want to talk about dissolved nitrogen in the bloodstream after scuba diving. So really simple, if you go scuba diving and it's a non-decompression dive, so that dive did not require a decompression stop, then that is 12 hours between your last dive and the time before you can go flying. And if you did have a decompression stop or your passengers did, this applies to you or your passengers, then you got to wait 24 hours. Now, your passengers will tell you, oh, I got a dive watch and that thing told me I'm good to go flying in just 4 hours. Well, you know, it's up to you as pilot in command, right? If you take off and they told you that and it hasn't been 12 hours, hasn't been 24 hours, whatever the limit was, and something happens to them, you're really responsible for that. You can say, oh, I'm going to fly low. We're not going to have much of a pressure change. We're just going to do some pattern work, some touch and goes. Shouldn't really matter, right? Well, these are the regulations the FAA sets forth, and we really recommend you follow those regulations. That is it for the medical factors topic here in the Instrument Pilot Ground School. Next up, we have spatial disorientation for IFR, which is a video, so you can go ahead and play through that, and there will be a short audio file in there to also walk you through the text in the spatial disorientation topic.